This is history 7, which means that we're still progressing with a technique that has a very complicated history, and it has a name. In fact, it has several names, but perhaps the best name is a phrase called accumulative penetration. In more clumsy times, when people still believed that objects were real and that you could just simply reach out and touch something, that kind of static block thinking was sufficient for an apprehension that somehow education was just words that carried a message and went in and registered, and your only problem was recovering those words. But it turns out that nothing is real at all in that scenario. Reality is not of objects that are statically there. What is, quote, there is an interpenetration of circumstances and vibrations that on every dimension is temporary, more or less, and our whole self with which we use to apprehend is a dynamic tornado of a whirl of gestalts that hardly ever is focused. And even the process of language is such a dynamic, recreating, recalibrating medium that it's like a wild horse that needs taming, and even then you have to be careful because it can throw you. And so that whole scenario of the simple education that here's someone who knows, who tells you about a subject matter that stays put, and then you should just remember what it was that you were told. None of that is true. That whole scenario is false. It's an illusion. It never has happened. It never does happen. It won't happen. So accumulative penetration is rather the reoccurring attempt to keep refocusing over and over again so that the wave front of your attention keeps approaching and finally getting to that multidimensional focus that who knows exactly where it is, but by an accumulated penetration, we finally come into contact, at least with the area, with the gestalt, which we wish to understand. With the proviso that it is a conscious action on our part, because we cannot just as some kind of neuter, sending station, send out a vibronic wave of apperception, we are carried with it. So that perception, rather than being a mechanical situation, is very much a mystical aliveness. In the ancient world, perception was thought to be little tiny instances of material flex that finally went and made physical contact with something, bounced off them, and then came physically back in these little specks and made contact. It's like the comic books in the 1940s where someone would look and they would send daggers to somebody. It's that kind of a thing, and it doesn't happen at all. That perception is always creative. It's enormously dynamic. And when perception comes from you as a conscious person, your dimensions of conscious space-time override completely, in a creative sense, the natural function of just sound waves or of a visual acuity or of any kind of sense-perceptual medium. So that by the time we become conscious in our education, in our learning, we have a differential quality, which when added to the integral quality that we had in our earlier learning experience here. We have a combination which is extremely potent. But in order to learn something, we have to jettison the thing. That we're not learning something at all, but learning is a process in and of itself, and that every aspect of it is open to improvement. That is, not only are we having a carrier wave of learning, which scoops us up and takes us along with it, so that we not only learn, but while we learn, we ourselves change. We minutely change, and sometimes we enormously change, while we're in the process of learning. But also, it's like quantum physics emphasizes since the middle of the century, the observer changes what's observed also. So there's a very odd situation. To the extent that we understand, our understanding refashions the learner and refashions what is learned at the same time. So that there's actually a very slippery sleight of hand quality that requires an alertness. The better that we learn, the more that we change, and the more what we have learned is recalibrated. And to the extent that we become very good at learning, we literally recast the world with every glance. And we ourselves are different. The phrase is, I am not the man I once was. Or one is not the woman one once was. No one is on a minute scale. But especially in a learning situation, and one that's high-powered like this, this two-year cycle is equivalent to about 30 years of human life. So the compression ratio is about 15 to 1, which means that we have an acceleration. So that every 3 weeks we're learning at the rate of what in nature would take a whole year, would take an annual cycle to experience, to digest, and we're doing that in 3 weeks. So we have a tremendous compression, and it means, too, that we are so powerfully approaching our material, our what it is that we're learning, that we're influencing it and we're changing it at a radical pace. And so we need to be conscious of the fact that even as we look at the material, it is changing, it is dissolving, it is morphing before our accumulated penetrative perception. This makes learning a very active kind of a process. And it's not at all the school classroom model. One might say that the school classroom model is like the Victorian stage theater model. The audience sits in rows here, the actors are on stage, and they perform the play here exactly as it's written, and the audience takes it. That entire scenario is obviated completely by what is happening here. This is not even the modification of theater in the round. This is not even where the audience is the participants, where they're the only actors that's there. But it's one step beyond that. It's a step which an existentialist dramatist early in the 20th century, an Italian named Pirandello, wrote a play called Six Characters in Search of an Author. We are an audience who are the actors themselves, but we do not have a script and we're looking for one. And in order to have a script, we're looking for an author who does not exist because the complex, condensed motion of our acting ability has transcended there being a playwright, a author, who would be complex enough to be able to give us a script. And so what happens is that the play is literally whatever it is that is happening and does happen. And our tendency is to think that all of that is free-formed and thus chaotic. And in fact, we know from experience of men and women who have done this for thousands of years that when you get caught up into that ultimate participatory chaos, that more and more universal structures come through that were there all the time. Why are there universal structures? Because in order for the material universe to stay, even temporarily, what it is, it has to polarize. Matter, atoms, molecules can't be atoms and molecules unless they hold a polarity structure, at least for a while. And so you have a polarizing theme that happens all the time, so that chaos is always polarized. It's like in chaos theory. If you run a computer graph on some chaotic event, the classic one was a leaky faucet dripping. If you keep track of the random drips of a leaky faucet, eventually, over some larger scale tracking, you will see that there is a double attractor, like an infinity sign graph, that begins to assert itself, which is there courtesy of the universe. And so this polarized quality, this double attractor, this infinity sign, which is not made in some kind of clear-cut rut, but which is approximated over and over again, millions and millions of times, but in the overlay, in the gestalt, the effect is that one gets, in reality, even unbidden, even in chaos, you get a polarized kind of a syncopation that sends out vibrations, it sends out resonances, so that the waves of energy that define reality are all resonant arcs of this kind of bow, this infinity bow, of polarities having some kind of gestalt common focus. And so men and women, even thousands of years ago, tens of thousands of years ago, discovered within themselves a kind of a balance. An athlete has it. A yogi has it. Someone who comes into a sobering up suddenly has it. They discover, they uncover, they register that there is a calm. There's a horizon of calm within. That while the universe of the cacophony of chaotic events and perceptions and vibrations is happening, one has within a calm horizon that does not change. And that this calm horizon, when it's superimposed on this universal structure of that infinity butterfly double attractor polarizing focus effect, our inner calm horizon exactly bisects that infinity sign, and so that there's a common point. That is to say, the center of all action finds a corresponding point within on that horizon line. And because that horizon line within is not polarized, any point on it is the same as any other point. And so having a congruence of inner calm on the basis of vast experience produces a recognition point, a kind of a centering, where one realizes that there is some kind of effective axis between our inner calm and its focus, which is anywhere within. That there's an axis from that inner calm that touches the world exactly at its center. And realizing that, men and women came to understand that if they then exercise their inner calm center, they can bring the world into order. That you don't have to push mountains outside to get the world ordered, but you make that axial contact from your inner calm central point, and then what you do, in an interior sense, affects the world, and by maintaining a calm, the world comes into a kind of an ordering. It also gets a horizon, which doesn't change. And this horizon to the world that doesn't change does not come from nature, it's supernatural. It comes from within men and women. It doesn't come from the landscape. It doesn't come from events outside. It doesn't come from complications or non-complications. That all of those elements do not count. They're extraneous. What counts is that you find your inner horizon of equanimity and make some kind of axial connection from any point on that horizon and maintain it, and it will find the counterpoint at the center of the world. And by maintaining that, the world settles into a horizontal quality. This was a fantastic discovery tens of thousands of years ago, and it raised our species so that we ceased to be what we had been before. What we had been for millions of years was a version of fundamental primates that went back 70, 75 million years. But somewhere in the East Africa Rift Valley, about 4 million years ago, some common ancestor, we know from DNA studies that it was a woman, it was a female, that there was such a person as a genetic Eve who lived at that time in that locale and whose genetic trace in the DNA carries all the way through up to every living creature of the human race on the planet today. We are all vibronically related to someone who brought her center line into contact with the world in all of its turmoil, but on its vast scale where this infinity sign came with its center to an axial contact with some primordial 4-million-year-old woman. So that the very form by which genetic material, the double helix, conveys itself is like a dimensional play. It's a dimensional movement of that infinity sign. That infinity sign is like a double helix. So if one looks at a cross-section of the central nervous system, taking a cross-section through the human spine, you will see that there is the double helix, the infinity sign, in the very structure of the spinal cord for the neural system. And that is differential flowering, just like a flower, is the brain. And so physiologically, genetically, we carry the real impress of an event that actually did occur and still reoccurs and can reoccur at any time which we bring our maturity into an inner focus and allow the maintenance of that inner focus to contact the center of the world, and then slowly bring that world into a correspondence with our qualities. But of course, the slow pace of evolution was not enough for our ancient forebears. And after millions of years of just letting it happen naturally, there came a time when that pace was speeded up. And the speeding up of that pace had several levels, several layers. The discovery of fire, the discovery of making a flint arrowhead, the discovery of the wheel, the discovery, finally, of the way in which one can bring that inner horizon, not only in a single person, but that a whole tribe of people can have their horizons mesh so that the whole tribe will have a single point of equanimity. That they would set aside some day during the year in which the tribe gets together to make that equanimity of the people and to make that contact of their axis with nature and bring nature into an order which had a meshing with their order. And in time, tribes grew to be meta-tribes and larger, and finally about 2,000 years ago, it occurred to a group of men and women in a place called Rome that one could do this on a world scale, that you could make the entire world a single tribe. And what they wanted was to bring the power of mankind into a common equanimity and have that contact the whole world once and for all, and bring it into an order that it would never shake. This was the ideology of the founding of the Roman Empire. And they did it. But they did it in such a way that every little iota of disturbance was a challenge to them to not let it happen, not let it continue. Let's get right on it. Let's clean it up right now. Let's have it over with. So the Roman Empire founders, centered on Augustus Caesar, decided to have a single central symbol in the very center of Rome that would show that the equanimity of the Pax Romana had reached the world. And that when the whole world was at peace, it meant that the Roman peace was effective. And so there was a temple called the Temple of Janus. Janus was the two-faced god who looks at the past and the future at the same time. And the Temple of Janus was one of the most ancient structures in the city of Rome. Rome was founded about 753 BC. And by the time Augustus Caesar decided for once and for all that the two doors, the two portals on either side that faced each other in the Temple of Janus had only been closed once. That was by Numa Pompilius around 750 BC when he had built the original Temple of Janus and said that the whole city is at peace. Numa in 750 BC was thinking in terms of the 5,000 or 6,000 people that were the Rome at that time. Augustus Caesar was thinking of the Roman world, the city of Rome extending to the entire population of the world, that the whole world would be at peace. And then to symbolize it, he would close the doors, the two doors, sealing off past and future so that the present would be eternal. And so he closed the doors of the Temple of Janus. He closed them firmly after the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. He said, the entire world is at peace, and we mean to keep it that way. And of course, there was an outbreak someplace in this far-flung empire, and immediately, dozen legions were sent, and everything was completely dismembered. And the whole world was at peace again, and Augustus closed those damn doors again. And something else broke out, and immediately another 100 legions were sent to stamp them out permanently forever. And then Augustus got the idea that the only way to keep the doors of the Temple of Janus closed, to have the Pax Romana eternal, so that Rome would be the eternal city, was to make sure that one aspect of the world that had not been taken into consideration initially, they'd taken into consideration military power, political intrigue, geographical control, economic factors, even social-cultural factors, mythology, but they had not taken into consideration occult power. That because they had missed capturing the occult power of the world, the magic of deep, profound mystery religions, that had to be co-opted. That had to be worked into the Pax Romana. And so before, for the third time, he could close the gates of the Temple of Janus, Augustus Caesar sent out an edict that said every piece of prophetic writing in the world will be sent to Rome. And that he, as the head of Roman official state religion, the Pontifex Maximus, a position that he inherited from his uncle Julius Caesar, who was the first dictator to seize that for himself and said, in fact, he was the first Roman to become a god, the first Roman man, divine Julius. And Augustus felt that he would not expose himself to this kind of occult energy focus. He would not say that I am a god, but he would say I am the representative of that God focus. Every piece of prophetic writing, most of it at that time in Augustus' time, was the prophecies called the Sibylline Oracles. And it was under penalty of death that anyone anywhere in the world kept a scrap, even a fragment of a Sibylline Oracle. They paid attention to the Chaldean oracles, they paid attention to various other kinds of divinatory items, but it was the Sibylline oracles, especially, that the Roman Empire said, this is the standard of world prophecy. And so when he had them all, when they'd sift through all of them, for the third time he closed the doors of the Temple of Janus in Rome, and he said, the Pax Romana is now eternal. Nothing will ever change it. Will always be the same. And it seemed to be. Augustus ruled the world for 44 years. He had had power for about 15 years before that, so for almost 60 years. The average population age was somewhere in the early 60s, so that for most people, Augustus had been the emperor of the world for as long as they could remember. And when he died in 14 AD, there was a quiver of apprehension that went through the Roman Empire. His chosen successor, Tiberius, held up bravely and he said, we still have Augustus's wife, the Augusta. She's still alive, Livia. Livia, who had been such a fantastic beauty that when Augustus had seen her, he literally commanded that she be brought to him from her husband, and she was his queen for more than 40 years. She still was alive. And for about 14 years after Augustus died, his widow was still alive, and the Roman Empire went on with the illusion that Augustus was still there, that his empress was still there, and Tiberius did almost nothing to disturb that. He let it run, but it finally ran out. When the Augusta died in 28 BC, Tiberius felt some kind of a quiver. It's recounted in one of our texts, one of the books that we're reading, Tacitus. Tacitus in the Annals. He calls the beginning of this period of Roman life the Reign of Terror. The Reign of Terror. He says that when Tiberius became the emperor of the world and in charge of the equanimity of the Pax Romana and its influence on the world, he became increasingly sensitive to occult fluxions, the fluctuations in process. Newton used to call them fluxions. He used to say that Newton said one of the most challenging things about higher mathematics was to keep track of fluxions. That fluctuations that are in process are not things, but they're like waves. For Newton, one of the most precarious of all fluxions was gravity. How do you mathematically keep track of gravity? And even today, 1997, we don't find gravity waves, but we know that they probably exist. But 2,000 years ago, Tiberius Caesar was haunted by the need to keep track of the universe's quivers, and so he reached back to the only science available to him that had any pretensions on the scale, and that was astrology. That astrology kept track of these waves. And so more and more, Tiberius began to search for the world's greatest astrologer who would be his advisor in this precariousness of keeping track of the occult quivers of the world and of the inner world. In order to set this up, he realized that he had to have an astrologer who was accurate in his horoscopes, in his predictions. So Tiberius, increasingly haunted by paranoia, and as you can imagine, by superstitious, paradoxical wonderment, went to a kind of a castle on the coast south of Rome, and it was approached only by this rocky trail that went along the brink of the promontory. In fact, it was very near to the place where the ancient Cumaean Sibyl was said to have lived, the place where Aeneas, who founded Rome, went into the underworld to contact the Cumaean Sibyl to find out what her prophecy was about the future of Rome. And in the Aeneid, Virgil tells us that when Aeneas went into the underground world of the Cumaean Sibyl, that her world was a series of tunnels that opened up and opened up so that finally there were more than 100 mouths of these underground subterranean tunnels, so that when the Cumaean Sibyl spoke, her language had so much cacophony and echo that no one could hear it. And it was only due to Aeneas's divine-given gift that he could pick out the exact message from this cacophony. The landscape is just north of the metropolitan area of Naples, which incidentally is a volcanic geography. And in fact, the whole underground land there is riddled with tunnels, volcanic tunnels. And there's even underneath a great lake, Lake Avernus, a tremendous tunnel that in very ancient times they had cut windows that had this very odd shape where there was like a base, and then it went up like an isosceles triangle, and then narrowed and went up and then came together. You see that shape in Mayan esoteric architecture, and it's called, in the 20th century archaeology, it's called the Arch of Lablon. But in its elongated form, it was the accumulated penetration gateways to the focus of the prophetic Cumaean Sibyl's key to the world. So Tiberius positioned himself on this promontory, on this fabled landscape, and he had astrologers from all over the world brought to him along this precarious path, and they would make a prediction of what the future was to Tiberius, and Tiberius all the time was planning their death, that on the way back from this castle along this path, they would be thrown down to the surf on the rocks below. And every one of them was killed until he came to an astrologer named Thrasyllus, who, when he came to cast the horoscope, was absolutely in horror. And he looked at Tiberius and he said, "I am finished. I will die within the hour." And Tiberius knew he had found the man. Because if the man could predict his own unknown death, he could help him predict a course, a navigational chart for the Roman Empire and the occult quivers of the Pax Romana. All of this haunted not only Tiberius, this kind of equality, Tiberius Caesar, in line, in alignment with Augustus Caesar, with Julius Caesar. So all the Caesar line, all of the Caesars were in this alignment of holding the Pax Romana increasingly, not only by military power or economic power or geographic hegemony, but by the quivers of occult prophetic language. But the whole Caesar line came to a crashing end with Nero, who finally burnt the whole city of Rome. Why? Because one prophetic school of writing had never been integrated into the Pax Romana, and that was the mystical prophecies of the Jews. They'd completely overlooked this small sect of people in this far-off province of Judea. Just who the hell were they? What were their prophecies? We need to have them. We need to integrate them. We can't have a universal eternal empire without them. No wonder we've been having troubles. And so the next dynasty from the Caesars, the Flavian dynasty, founded by Vespasian and carried on by his two tyrannical sons, Titus and Domitian, sought to integrate Jewish prophecies. And Jewish prophecies at that time, Jewish prophecies in the first century AD, were all about the Messiah, all about the miracle-working Messiah who could individually change the world by himself. The Messiah who collected all of the inner energies, not only of the living, but of the dead, not only of the past and present, but of the future. So the entire horizon of equanimity of mankind as a species and all of its possibility were centered in this super godlike Messiah. And so it was that Vespasian, when the Caesar line came to a crashing end, was in the greatest concentration of Jewish people in the ancient world. He was in ancient Alexandria. Ancient Alexandria had, at that time, according to one of the great writers of the age, had over 1 million population. Jerusalem, the largest Jewish city, had somewhere around 100, 150,000 people. And so in Alexandria, as Tacitus tells us, Vespasian had these whispers from aides who were on top of the situation, because there are always those kinds of people. The Messiah ship is up for grabs. It's whoever can work the miracles. What miracles are there? There are especially the blind will see and the lame will walk, and that you will be able to emphasize that your vision of world peace is what holds. And Vespasian passed all those tests in Alexandria. Tacitus tells us about making the blind see, about making the lame walk. And increasingly, the Roman emperorship went to a different level, a level which Augustus Caesar at the founding of the Roman Empire had approximated, but Vespasian, very carefully learning a lesson from Augustus Caesar, do not make the mistake of Julius Caesar of putting yourself there at the center. And so Vespasian decided not to put himself so much there, though he would claim the power. He would be the new Roman emperor, and he was. But he did so in order to found a dynasty which his sons would carry out. And the occult vision that he had in Alexandria, he went to the great tomb of Alexander the Great, where Augustus had gone, when Augustus had won the world. He completed it in Alexandria at the tomb of Alexander the Great, and he went in and spent the night there by himself, wouldn't allow anyone else in the temple. And actually, in the tomb, which was a huge dome that had a solid gold coffin with a glass top so that the body of Alexander the Great was there, Augustus opened that by himself and touched the nose of Alexander the Great and broke it, this finger. But he had a dream in there, and that dream was the founding of the Roman Empire. But Augustus had never thought of Jewish prophecy as necessary for an eternal empire, whereas Vespasian specifically went in there, specifically went there to have an archetypal healing dream, courtesy of the goddess Asclepius, about the Jewish prophecies, about the Jewish messiahship. And in this way, what before had been a very small part of world concern was brought exactly to the center. The Jewish Messiah became the most important archetypal concern in the world all of a sudden at that time. It was 70 AD. He saw in a dream a man, a figure, a glowing figure, who identified himself as Basilides. And Vespasian said, I know you, but you are not here in Alexandria. And when he got up the next morning, he sent out scouts, and they located Basilides about 80 miles outside of Alexandria. He couldn't have come in person. So it was a dream figure. But why this man? But you have to understand, Vespasian was very well coached by metaphysicians, by occultists. They said, it's not the man, it's his name. Basilides means son of the king. You're gaining this for you to be king so that the sons of the kings will be the messiahs. And so Vespasian reinstituted and reinvigorated the Roman Empire on an occult religious basis that was a whole notch higher than that of the Caesars. And in order to ensure that there would be no more competitors, he sent his two sons to opposite ends of the empire. He sent Titus to Jerusalem to destroy it, and he did. He completely dismembered. They tore the temple in Jerusalem down so that all that is left today is actually called the Wailing Wall. And it was left as a memento of lamenting, endless lamenting, because the Roman Empire has taken your God from you. And the great menorah in the temple was taken to Rome. And as we said before, in the Arch of Titus, there in Rome still, you see the sculpture of the great menorah as the keystone for Roman imperial power. But what about the younger son, Domitian? Domitian was only 17. He was sent off to the Western European front, where he tried at 17 to usurp military power. And he was laughed at by the generals, who thought he was playing boyish pranks. And so Domitian disguised himself as a dreamy-eyed poet and waited and bided his time. And when he became Roman emperor, after Vespasian died, after Titus died, Domitian's whole reign was called the Reign of Terror all over again. Exactly. Just like Tiberius, only even more constrained. And it's Domitian, under Domitian, who's the one who brought the surviving prophetic voice of Jewish Christianity to Rome to interrogate him. That was St. John, the author of the fourth gospel. And Domitian, in an eerie sense, realized that he should not, he could not, he must not kill this man, for that would loose all these unintegrated powers out of his control forever. And so he jailed St. John. He jailed him in exile on a rocky island called Patmos. And that's where St. John wrote the book of Revelation, which was his inner archetypal vision rising up against this world of Roman Empire illusion, saying, "You think you have brought all the occult power in the universe into your city? You haven't even touched one planet of a whole cosmos of millions of stars." Let's take a break. We're used to using a pair of books together, and by pairing them, we get away from all of the problems of the text, both problems as a student who is assigned a text, which is a version of the Victorian stage model. You must read this material and pass a test X number of days. All of that is irrelevant to this. We're not reading books as texts. We're pairing books together, and we're using them to play off each other in a very sophisticated way. Towards the end of the first century AD, it became very much an issue that the complexities of a human personality were mostly subterranean. That is to say, the complexities of a human person were in a vast inner world, so that the external world of an individual was just the tip of the iceberg. And there was no way to know yourself just by watching what you do externally or watching other people externally. You had to find some way to get into them or some way to get into you, this kind of a quality, so that you had, towards the end of the first century, an author like Plutarch, who wrote a whole series of parallel lives. He said the form of a human life is so complex that you need a background complex enough to handle that scintillating form of the human person. And that the human person had become so complex as a form that nature was no longer a sufficient background against which to see the form. A person in a landscape was no longer able to deliver a very refined portrait because the person was just too brilliant vis-a-vis this kind of dullness of the world. So Plutarch came up with the startling idea, it was a religious idea, that the only background complex enough against which to see the full complexity of a human person was another person. So if you took parallel lives, you learn to see these two people in terms of each other as backgrounds. That they were not parallel so much in terms that they had lived similar lives, but they were paralleled in the technique of this penetration, this spiritual penetration, to see the inner jewel. And that the reader, the one who read, or the listener, because very often in antiquity at that time, one would listen to books. Reading silently to oneself was a meditative technique that only very few men and women knew. Mostly people read books out loud. In Roman schools, if you didn't read your lessons out loud, you were rapped in the knuckles. So language was always kept out loud. Why is that so? Because spoken language tends to be mythic, whereas a language read silently tends to interiorize and become magical. And an inner language has a whole different quality. A silent inner language has an entirely different quality. It has a differentiating quality. Whereas a spoken language has an integrating quality. When you speak to have the language narrate, to keep to the storyline. Whereas a silent language exfoliates in ways adventurously that one never knew. You can explore. So with silence, you can explore. There was a Chinese writer in the 30s and 40s named Chang Yi, who traveled the great Western cities of the world without speaking, because he was Chinese. He was a very subtle Taoist, and he wrote a whole series of books called The Silent Traveler, The Silent Traveler in London, The Silent Traveler in San Francisco. It was a way of disclosing the madness of the 20th century by a silent traveler. So the reader was a silent traveler who went with Chang Yi. And in a way, it's a version of the parallel lives. Well, our parallel books are like this technique, because we're looking at a book in such a complex way, a way which even in the 21st century won't be fully mastered. It's like 22nd century quality of looking with the eyes of an interior jewel cutter. That whatever we look at in the 22nd century, we look at in such a creative, penetrative, cognitive way that we re-see it in a thousand ways. We don't just take it as this, but we take it as the whole gestalt and penumbra of all of its possibilities at once. And a couple hundred years from now, there'll be men and women who just grow up that way. They'll be able to get the world in each thing in such a multidimensional, instantaneous way that we will look like cave dwellers to them. So we're trying to get into the beginnings of this kind of equality. In the ancient world, in the 2nd century AD, after Plutarch's parallel lives, after several developments, after all of this concern with occult dimensions of the world, and it became a real cause célèbre, a real issue, they realized that political power depended upon it, that world dominion depended upon it, personal integration depended upon it. So in the 2nd century, one develops this kind of sensitivity to the multifaceted quality of life. And the Romans were never able to master it, because the Romans so quickly took over the world that they swallowed whole populations without ever having gone through the long evolution that those populations had gone through to gain their wisdom, their experience. And so, like a glutton, Rome simply swallowed too many people and had indigestion. But later on, when the Roman Empire itself abandoned Rome, said, well, it's too far gone, it can't be saved. They founded a new Rome, a whole new city, Byzantium. They said, we're going to start from scratch. And Constantine the Great said, not only are we going to start from scratch, but we're going to integrate as the central synthesizing vision this little Jewish cult that became Christianity. We're going to found the new Roman Empire on Christianity. And what developed out of that was the Byzantine kind of vision that in antiquity was called the jeweled ornament style, which was kind of a reductive way of seeing multi-dimensions at one and the same time. It focused on being able to see in infinite mystical dimensions one single icon, because it was Roman Empire style reductivism. Because in the empire model, there can only be one person, a dictator for life, who's the center of the world. And that there's a pecking order down from that. But when it was first new, when the Roman Empire was refashioned the first time by the Flavian dynasty, after the Caesars, when they were trying to integrate the mystical Jewish prophecies of the Messianic New Age into their mix, it occurred to them to at least ask the question, well, who are the Jews anyway? And as we can see from Tacitus, that there was absolutely no idea whatsoever. The Jews were seen, for instance, here's how Tacitus writes it. He wrote this about 100 AD, after all these events had come to a temporary conclusion. It is said the Jews are refugees from Crete, who settled the furthest part of Libya at the time when Saturn was forcibly deposed by Jupiter. And then he goes into the whole name that on Crete there's a mountain named Ida, and that Ida is somehow Judea, spelled with another. Or he says, the others say that the Jews are from Ethiopia. The Jews, there are many who think the Jews of Ethiopian stock, driven by fear and hatred to immigrate in the time of King Cephas. And then he goes on to trace other ancestries for the Jews on mythological bases. But finally he says that the Jewish prophet to themselves is Moses, but that everyone knows about Moses and the Jews being thrown out of Egypt. He says, most authorities agree that a foul and disfiguring disease once broke out in Egypt, that is leprosy, and that King Bachoris, on approaching the oracle of Amun and inquiring for a remedy, was told to purge his kingdom and transport all the victims into another country. So they were escorted out of Egypt and thrown into the deserts of Sinai to die there, because they were all leprous. A motley crowd was collected and abandoned in the desert, while all the other outcasts lay idly lamenting. One of them, named Moses, advised them not to look for help to gods or men, since both had deserted them, but to trust rather in themselves and accept as divine the guidance of the first being by whose aid they should get out of their present plight. Now, Tacitus is one of the most learned men of his time. So you can see that there was no historical understanding of many things. The only thing that they understood really well was their own history, and everything was integrated in terms of that. In other words, it was put through a reductive sieve till the only thing that they became certain of again and again was that the Roman integration was the only right one, and that the center of the Roman integration was Roman law. So the Roman Empire became very good at a universal legal system that exemplified itself in a universal military, and in a secular way exemplified itself by Roman engineering of making good roads that could be repaired forever and colossal buildings that showed the power of the Roman people. But in terms of subtleties, in terms of the inner quivers, whether occult or not, the Romans were never very good at it at all. And they translated everything into a Latin language that became more and more blocky as time went on. Because Latin is an interiorizing language in those days was very much like the official engraved names that would be put on stone buildings. That was kind of like the quality of the Latin that was there to be written in red. Hence we get the conviction that something is only true if it's engraved on stone, which is a Roman ideal. And if you don't see it engraved in stone on the public buildings, well, then it's not true, is it? And so you can see this kind of reductive mentality became almost like a disease. Let's jump 1,500 years forward into the future. Let's jump to a time when this kind of interior quality had become so second vision, second rate, second nature, that by the time you get to a mystic like Teresa of Avila, and we're pairing Tacitus with Teresa of Avila, her autobiography, you get a kind of a portrait like this of someone who's convinced that suffering in this world is very good for you because it keeps alive the very tensions that are necessary to get down to conviction that can be engraved on stone. What about the inner world? Teresa writes, "O secrets of God, I would never tire of trying to explain them if I thought I could in some way manage to do so. Thus I will say 1,000 foolish things, in order that I might at times succeed and that we might give great praise to the Lord. I said that this union was not some kind of dreamy state, the union with the divine within. It's not some kind of dreamy state, because even if the experience in the dwelling place that was mentioned is abundant, the soul remains doubtful that it was union. It doubts whether it imagined the experience, whether it was asleep, whether the experience was given by God, or whether the devil transformed himself into an angel of light. It is left with 1,000 suspicions. That it has them is good, for as I have said, even our own nature can sometimes deceive us in that dwelling place. Though there is not so much room for poisonous things to enter, some tiny lizards do enter. Since these lizards have slender heads, they can poke their heads in anywhere. And even though they do no harm, especially if one pays no attention to them, as I said, they are often a bother, since they are little thoughts proceeding from the imagination and from all the things I have mentioned. But however slender place, for there is neither imagination nor memory nor intellect that can impede this good, yet I would dare say that if the prayer is truly union with God, the devil cannot even enter as a little lizard and do damage." And so one has a very peculiar paradox. The differential dimensions of conscious time-space, of spiritual seeing, are imprisoned into an integral mode that in order to work has to be more and more powerfully reductive. And it's very good for you to be forced to reduce down, to get to that unmistakable conviction which can be engraved in stone. Caught in this kind of a bind, most of the histories of successors of the Roman Empire have met with horrific fates. It wasn't until the 20th century, though, that human beings have had to live with the most monstrous replays of this whole kind of scenario. What is monstrous about it is that consciousness becomes reduced down into a form of thought called an ideology. Here's a definition of an ideology written by one of Europe's greatest thinkers. He wrote it having survived the Second World War. He wrote it in Berlin in 1948. His name is Karl Jaspers. An ideology is a complex of ideas or notions, which represents itself to the thinker as an absolute truth for the interpretation of the world and his situation within it. It leads the thinker to accomplish an act of self-deception for the purpose of justification, of obfuscation, of evasion, that in some sense or other, this belief is to his own advantage. And that the peculiar thing in the 20th century is that this involution has taken such a curious turn that it's become paradoxically involuted. So that by now, Jaspers writing in 1948, the high daring of self-reflective consciousness that is a precondition of all truthfulness has degenerated along the path of ideological theory. So that the very process of thinking in possibilities has fractured itself, and one then does not believe any conclusion, but only the continued ability to doubt that there is any conclusion, and that this becomes then the ideological conviction. And that it leads increasingly to the state that we have today, 1997. That this regressive ideological system the very people who spurn everything that is believed, thought, and imagined as being somebody else's ideology are frequently themselves possessed by the most stubborn ideology consisting in this mode of interpretive, this kind of deconstruction, this kind of critical sass, this conviction, this ideological conviction, which can be in itself carved in stone, that nobody else's ideas are necessarily true for me, or that my ideas of yesterday are not necessarily true for me. And so one gets into a paradoxical morass where nothing is possible except an increasing confidence that carrying doubt farther and farther out is progress. Jaspers writes that this process of unmasking untruth in others, in situations. This process of unmasking has now ceased to be an unveiling and has become a malicious form of attack. It is not critical investigation, but suggestion. Not empirical exposition, but mere assertion. So that to suggest by increasing forceful assertion creates this in-your-face quality where plausibility seems constantly to illumine on any particular assessment. Thus, the method of penetrating cognition of truth has ended up as the abasements of psychology and of the thought that completely loses truth simply by its exercise. Everything is ideological in this thesis, and itself becomes an ideology. Nothing is left except that one increasingly is hungry for, craves, martyrs. Someone's to blame. Something is to blame. And they goddamn well should be punished. And so there's this kind of equality. This was written in 1948, published in 1949. And one can see that we have pretty much gone along this track. How does this happen? How does this happen that habits of systematic misintegration that have their roots thousands of years ago have any kind of traction whatsoever now? None of us are Romans. Where is the basis upon which that can happen? Because, as we talked about at the beginning today, the very process of perception, of conscious time-space apperception, carries with it the viewer. How you look carries along he or she who looks. And that changes the very, quote, objects which one has seen, one is seeing. And over time, this develops into a skew. And it's like a golf swing that's wrong. A slice never rectifies itself. A trajectory, once it begins on a skew, will carry. It'll carry as far as the ball goes, carry off the greens. And so this kind of askew that came into empire making on a planetary scale 2,000 years ago carries within it a built-in skew that over the last 2,000 years, instead of being mitigated, has simply been amplified, has made it so much an impress that the conviction now for several hundred years has been that there must be some way out of this by not participating at all in any of these developments. So the search is on the basis, what people have not been co-opted into this? Let's go look at those people. Let's see how they live, how they think. Non-Roman empire mentalities. Non-Roman European history of thoughts and ideas. And this, of course, gained ground within the last 100 years. One takes a look at the development of world anthropology, at the looking not only at other peoples who have not been folded into this process, but of looking at oneself in a primordial way before you've been co-opted into this kind of a process. But in all of this, there is a basic focus that reoccurs almost like some kind of repeating pulsar signal. that the history has not been all of one piece, that there has been some kind of a landscape that has more or less peaks of intensity and energy and focus, and that the greatest peak occurred some 500 years ago. And that at this peak, some 500 years ago, there was a fundamental shift, a fundamental change, a quality that made some kind of a difference. One of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century, a woman named Hannah Arendt, said that there are three different qualities that come into play 500 years ago, almost like some kind of new triad of concerns. One is the discovery of the Western hemispheres and the fact that we have really a spherical world and that most of it is not been included in the so-called history, in the so-called empire, in the so-called religions, in the so-called experience of civilization, that history has been very delimited. I think the Alexandrian understanding, even 300 BC by Eratosthenes, was that the known world to the Greeks at that time was only 1/27th of the entire sphere of the planet. That understanding that the Earth was a sphere, and by computing the angle of the noon sun at different parts of the known world, figured out that in terms of a complete sphere, the entire known world was only 1/27th of the sphere. Hannah Arendt says in The Human Condition, she says the discovery of and the need to include the entire planet, the entire sphere, but at the same time as that concern became indelible and worked itself out over the centuries, was the conviction that somehow the human person, the individual, could be transformed in ways that had not been explored. There were new ways that transformation itself, as a technique, could be transformed. And that when you transformed transformation, you got new possibilities of individuality that no one had ever seen or tried. And because they were wide open, they were literally infinite, there were infinite ways in which to be individual that no one had ever explored. So one had a new planet, one had a new realm of the individual. And the third thing, she says, is the discovery of the telescope, of the ability to see incredible increasing detail in the cosmos. That the entirety of our planet was only one entirety in a universe that evidently has almost endless, quote, entireties. Entireties without number. Worlds without number. And she says, over the last 500 years, these three together have worked like this braided drill of opening up differentially the possibilities so that we live, she was writing The Human Condition, 1958. She says, we live in a universe now that has boundless opportunity, but that very boundless opportunity is a source of infinite jeopardy to those who have authority and control. Because there's no way to guarantee. There's not one little group of prophecies that have been left out. It's that the whole mass of the universe has been left out. One hasn't computed even 1/1,000,000th of what is real. And so there is no empire in effect. And never was. What then have we been living? We thought it was a history. We thought it was history. Now we realize it wasn't even a history. It's nowhere. And so at the beginning of his book, Carl Jaspers writes here, man's history has largely disappeared from memory. Only through investigation and research does it become accessible and then only to a very small extent. We and the present in which we live are situated in the midst of history. This present of ours becomes null and void if it loses itself within the narrow horizon of the day, which then degenerates into a mere present. That the difficulty of this is to find some way to explore without falling into old habits. Some way in which to give ourselves an opportunity to make not only a form of person for ourselves and a context of history for that person to live in, but all of the other issues are also there, wide open and boundless. What is nature? What works in existence? What makes anything objectively real? What is language? How do we know how to say anything? It isn't just a question of vocabulary or grammar or syntax, but of possibility of meaning itself. And on that basis, then, what is mind? Whatever is this interior focus, what is a symbol? What are ideas? How do they work? And so the issue is one where all of these concerns are up for grabs at the same time. But remember something that was archaically possible. There was a time, more than 100,000 years ago, when men and women were able to find an equanimity, a sense of the horizon of stillness within, before there was any of this stuff. And it wasn't because they searched for it, or they hoped for it, or they grabbed it. It was because of a universal characteristic of reality that it does have a horizon of stillness that has some kind of axial connection to the entirety of the world as a single process of complexity. That the complexity of the world and the simplicity of the interior link together in some axial sort of a way. So that there is a correspondence between, so that there is an interpenetration of them. And it's this quality that we can trust. There was a beautiful beginning to a film. I think it was the first film that John Milius did the film script for. It was called Conan the Barbarian with Arnold. And the young boy who became Arnold, who became Conan, is listening to this old man tell him about how you cannot trust the world, you can't trust people, you can't trust this and that. And then he held up his sword and he hits his hand. He said, "You can trust in this because you learn how to use it." It's like the sword of Conan. The horizon of inner stillness is something that one can trust because you can learn to use it. You can learn to establish from scratch, without any preconceptions or preconditions, that exact, precise, axial connection with the world as a whole, no matter how complex it is, no matter how large the universe is. Its entirety focuses in a way that is accessible for you on your inner balance. And so 500 years ago and 200 years ago, there are two nodes in the development of world civilization that stand out. They stand out because they're moments when men and women had glimpses of what we are now coming to understand is primordial, The inner balance is always real, and it always has the ability to contact the center of the complexity of the universe, no matter how big. 500 years ago was the conviction that in antiquity, not everybody was a Roman citizen. Not everybody was co-opted into the Roman Empire. There must have been men and women who understood what was real. Let's try and find out who they were and get in touch with what they wrote, get in touch with what they did. And that period was called the Renaissance, the rebirth of the esoteric spiritual core of antiquity. Not the stuff engraved on stones, but the stuff that men and women talked about secretly with each other. There must have been some evidence of it, something left. Let's try and find that. And then 200 years ago was the conviction that whatever complexity there is, its center correspondence is to the most complete sense of inner equilibrium. And so 200 years ago, there was a generation of men and women who were convinced that one had to have the wildest, most primordial, grand interior horizon possible. And that period was called the Romantic Revolution. The belief, the conviction, the expectation, the discovery that the inner calm was not always some kind of monkish, ascetic calm, but sometimes was an inner certainty of wild grandeur. That there was a torrential calmness within oneself that one could tap. And that it was on the basis of this that the whole of the universe was evocatively called out to come into play. That one of the difficulties was the preconception that quiet was some kind of ascetic, monastic quality, and it didn't have to be that at all. Because cavemen and cavewomen were not monks. They were tough enough to bring down the mammoths, the saber-toothed tigers. Yet they had this ability. They had this wild, elegant, romantic hero equanimity. How do we know? We know now, they didn't 200 years ago, but we can see the ancient cave paintings of 30, 40,000, 50,000 years ago from various parts of Africa and southern Europe. And when we look at those cave paintings, we see the wild animal populations upon which their life depended, and almost like some kind of mystical seal, we see the handprint of men and women in the center of the overlapping gestalt of these wild animals. That somebody had understood that they were a part, a synthesizing, centering part of this whole wild world. That the wildness of the world made sense in terms of the wild equanimity which they were able to experience within. And that they put these images not in the sunlight, but they put them in caves underground, so far away, so convoluted that you would have to go by torchlight for sometimes more than an hour just to get there, and to secretly have this disclosed to each other, that this is what is true, that the secret of the reality is that the world responds to how we are real. And if we are elegantly wild, the universe turns into a lover rather than a mother. And on that basis, life gets juice that it never had before. And out of that comes children of promise that would never have been born had they have not been conceived. We're going to get to another pair of books in 2 weeks. We're going to get to Burckhardt's Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, and to Hegel's lectures on the philosophy of world religion. But as these pairs of books go along, our technique has always been to not just let the pairing continue, because it has a tendency then to become a paradox. The ancient wisdom tradition was to let the pairing continue for a series of three stages. Once you have three, you have the first sense of a form. The triangle is the most simple of forms. And once you have three, you look for where the center is. And so after three pairs of books, we take one. We take a single book. These single books are special. They're documents from all over the world, and the one we're going to take at the end of history is from India. It's called the Dhammapada. It's the history of the steps that one takes along the middle path. The Dhammapada is not a book about Buddhism. It's not an ism. But it is the record of the way in which your footprints would register if you walked on the middle way, not touching any of the polarities in the world ever. What would your steps be? One is reminded of that most remarkable discovery that Mary Leakey made now 30 years ago or 40 years ago, when she was near Lake Turkana, the African Rift Valley area, and she ran across the footprints of a woman and her child from about 2.5 million years ago that had been made in volcanic dust that had swiftly been covered by lava and had been preserved. And in some mystical, magical way, they were uncovered enough for Mary Leakey to find them and to astonishingly prove to the world that human beings, a woman and her child, 2.5, almost 3 million years ago, left footprints very much like we would. The shape of the foot was very much like ours, with the arch, and the ball, and the toes, and so forth, showing that bipedalism had been around for a long time. That man as a creature isn't just recent. And that the point isn't that we're millions of years old as a species, but that we're the integral flower of billions of years of reality. And so that human beings are very, very ancient. They're as ancient as the universe itself. And that's why our inner equanimity has a correspondence directly, not only with the planet and the stars, but the universe as a whole. That connecting bar is not disproportionate, the universe and us. The Renaissance conviction was quite accurate. The ancient men and women of wisdom saw that we have an interior universe as complex as the exterior one. That we, as we are a focus between two infinities. Every single one of us. And the question is, why then aren't we rich? It's why then don't we treat each other with respect, given this infinity? More next week. Thank you.